right? It's just like, whoop! Oh, sorry, I've just punched Michelle in the face. Are you okay? Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Geordie.
Welcome.
Welcome, welcome. What a treat. I can reach out and touch
Reach out and touch.
Do you know what? I had a whole conversation with Andreas, who is not a music fan in general. And I said, I think it's reach out and touch me. And he said, it's faith.
I think it's reach out, touch, face. No, it's faith.
Touch face. I'll touch your face.
He was right.
Yeah. And I actually said this to you just recently. I'm happy to be wrong. I don't mind being wrong.
Happy?
Really, if I'm wrong and I'm corrected, I don't mind it.
You can take it.
I can take it.
That's good, because a lot of people get defensive when they're told that they're wrong about things and they can't bear it. But it doesn't mean that you're a dum-dum, does it?
A dum-dum.
We can all learn. We can all grow. And guess what, people? You are learning and growing today, because we are going to kamikaze pilot our way into your eardrums with another episode of Eavesdropping the Podcast with me, Geordie.
And I'm Michelle. You're an eavesdropper because you're eavesdropping on us.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome aboard. Take these facts and run. Go and tell them every time you see someone, like when you're sitting on a bus next to someone, guess what I heard? XYZ. It'll be wrong.
Throw out some incorrect facts.
Do be prepared to be educated and corrected when you go around spouting what we tell you.
And just be happy to be wrong. Take a leaf out of my book. Not happy to be wrong, but if you're wrong, take it. Just blame us.
Because you're an evolved human, Michelle. That's why. Clearly. You must be.
So what has been going on?
We had some emails, as you pointed out. Now, listeners, we love it when you write in. I have a bit of a problem with technology, therefore I can't personally respond at the moment. But I had a lot to say to our dear listener, Charlene, from the UK, in fact. She's been very vocal recently. She gave us some information that Boots now sell a travel pussy, which was news to me.
Well, it's not a travel pussy. It's a travel pee. The penine. It's a travel peen.
What?
You put your D in the crystal light or something.
Wow.
And then you give it a little up and down.
Is that like an LED so your skin's nice at the end?
Do you know what? If they combined it, you could give a pee, a facial, as well as some good times.
I love how you're just reducing all these anatomical terms to the first letter.
It's a D, it's a P, it's a D.
It's a V.
It's a V.
It's a pair of T's. A pair of B's or T's.
Depending on how crude you want to be, Geordie.
Well, I like this new Michelle. She's cleaned up her act. That means that the under 16s can now listen, because the F's and B's and C's and S's are all...
Fuck that shit.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my Off God. She goes. No.
Now, listen, Charlene, here's to you, Charlene. We love it when you write in. Great minds think alike, my dear girl, because she heard us talking about Jodie Foster a few episodes ago, not the last week's episode, because we had already done that by the time I got the email. She said something, though, that I didn't know about regarding Jodie Foster and her stalker, John Hinckley Jr., who assassinated President Ronald Reagan.
Well, tried.
For her. Tried to. So what Charlene told me that I didn't know was that when he was watching the Golden Globes award speech ceremony, whatever, that Jodie Foster gave and kind of came out, even though it was an open secret for many years that she was a lesbian, she kind of finally said it for reals when she was accepting a speech in 2013. And Charlene raised it that apparently John Hinckley Jr. lost his shit from his room at the St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., where he'd been there for 31 years.
Under psychiatric care.
Absolutely. And when he saw her admit she prefers women during her speech for, it was actually the Cecil B. DeMille Award acceptance speech, she kind of came out by saying this: I have a sudden urge to say something that I've never really been able to air in public. She went on then to thank one of the deepest loves of my life, my heroic co-parent, my ex-partner in love, but righteous soul sister in life, my confessor, ski buddy, consigliere, whatever that is, most beloved BFF of 20 years, Cindy Bernard. So
wow.
The response from Hinckley in his room at the facility was, this information would have been useful a few decades earlier. He was angry. He added that he immediately threw away all his Jodie Foster memorabilia. And he said, if I had known I never had a chance with Jodie because I'm a man, I wouldn't have tried to assassinate the president to get her to like me. I mean, that's twisted thinking. 31 years in, he still hasn't shown that he's been
rehabilitated.
I mean, God, don't say that out loud, John.
And also too, mate, I'm just putting it out there. You never had a chance.
You never had
Not
a
even
chance.
If she liked men.
Exactly.
You never had a chance.
So as Charlene said in her email to us, hospital staff was forced to sedate Hinckley Jr. after he became furious during the speech, not only because of the facts that came out that she was a lesbian, but also because the speech went on too long and it held up the rest of the show.
Oh,
furious.
He was pissed off.
Furious.
Stay in the facility, mate.
He's out.
What?
I told you that last week, Michelle.
I forgot it. I'm sorry. Oh, wow. Well, look, thank you so much, Charlene. Amazing that you sent that information in. Say what? So, Geordie, speaking of what's dropped into the inbox, we had a really fascinating email from a woman called Karen Irving. The subject line was Hampstead SRA hoax. And for anyone who's been an eavesdropper for a while, you covered the story of the Hampstead hoax. Maybe do a little recap.
Okay, so obviously Hampstead hoax has just been out on Channel 4 for those of us in the UK who can watch it. It was drawn to my attention when a friend sent me a clip of these two young children saying all sorts of crazy shit, like that they're parents were forcing them into a sexual satanic abuse cult, and they named loads of people like their teachers, and they knew where this abuse was taking place. The police got involved and they searched all the places that were mentioned, couldn't find a single thing. And then it came out gradually, bit by bit, it was a hoax.
It was all made up.
Formulated by the children's mother, who wanted sole custody, and her new boyfriend, who actually had form and had done this kind of thing with families that he's been linked to in the past, which is, if he gets pissed off, he'll get social services on you by making up shit. And he has a way of convincing the children to peddle his lies, because he slaps them on the top of their head with a spoon until they get it right, so to speak. So the ultimate in coercion. But unfortunately for the people involved in this hoax, mums and dads, I was explaining it to my husband the other day, regular people with kids in primary school were getting accused of all sorts of horrible paedophilia and crimes of trafficking their own children. And trolls who believed the lies actually would break into their emails and whatnot and their Facebook and would publish pictures of 9-year-old girls and say, this girl is the star of a pornographic film thanks to her parents. Then the parents would get phone calls from America from people who wanted to slam them for being so disgusting and vile, or phone calls from paedophiles asking how much.
Yeah, it was horrific. Interestingly, this woman, Karen Irving, she says here by happenstance and quite belatedly, because obviously there's been a whole lot of renewed interest in the Hampstead hoax because of the Channel 4 documentary that's just aired in the last couple of weeks. She says she stumbled across our podcast and your episode that you did on the whole Hampstead.
Which is a bit scary. People actually listen.
People are listening. And she says, I'm the person who interviewed for the Alexi Monstrous podcast that you referenced, Geordie. And she said, I used to write the Hoaxstead research blog until I shut it down a couple of years ago. Weirdly, the woman who was very much involved in this has got in touch. That's the upshot of this.
She was only involved, let's point out, from memory. I'm afraid I didn't go back and look at my research, but I seem to remember that Karen had a blog. She's in Canada, and she had a blog that would just keep her in touch with her sisters. And one of her sisters went to a gallery in Hampstead. And as a result, the picture was posted on her blog. And as a result of that, somehow it got dragged into the cyber attacks. And then she was at the center of it.
Yep.
Not by design, by default somehow. And she was actually instrumental in getting to the bottom of a lot of the misinformation, if you like.
Yeah.
But unfortunately for Karen, I did a little Google of her yesterday. Those trolls are still at it. There's YouTube videos, those cobbled together shouty YouTube videos about her being involved with shell companies, proven to be a liar. She's covering up for paedophile rings. That's not true. I'm going to say this out loud right now. I believe you, Karen. That's disgusting that people's lives can be, I mean, you just have to disagree with someone and shit will fly at you and it will stick. And there's no way of proving otherwise. This era of misinformation that we're in, it's scary, Michelle. You know, I'm training to be a counselor. One of my supervisors said to me the other day, be careful when you're advertising your services on Facebook, because he knows of two people who are counselors who randomly had sex videos of themselves, AI, posted AI on their advertising pages. And that's really hard to escape from and very damaging to your livelihood, let me add.
But also, at least everybody knows now that there is really intense AI that can create your face on a nude body and have it look really realistic. So I think, you know, people are being more educated about it. It's really awful.
What it seems to do, though, now you hear this from us, and we're not the first to say this, but other people are saying it too. Oh, you know, look out, because it might look like Obama's dancing on a rooftop, but he never did. You know, this is the dangers of AI, whatever, and misinformation. Don't believe everything you're told. So what the fuck do we believe? This era of misinformation is leading to an era of mistrust. When we can't trust anyone, where does that leave us with our mental health and in our psyches? I think it's dangerous.
I hope it means that people will be more and more engaged in real life, things that you can touch, people in front of you. But even still, this is the Wild West of AI, of social media, the whole lot. But going back to Karen, she says in her email, this really is one of those stories that won't die. And for good reason, as I think it tells us a lot about how the internet affects people's critical thinking abilities.
That's what I said, Karen.
Exactly. And how easy it is to lose one's moral compass in the face of seemingly, inverted commas, truthful videos.
That is what I said, Karen. See, she's on the same page.
She's on the same page. Like those Hampstead children were forced to make. And she says, as well, I think the Hampstead hoax was one of the foundational elements of the American Pizzagate conspiracy theory.
Totally.
And ultimately of QAnon.
Yep, it's the granddaddy of QAnon.
And we made all these connections at the time in your summing up of
this. Yes, we did. But that was thanks to Alexi Mostras's podcast, which is, I can't remember what it was called now.
Yes, I don't remember either. We should have done that research.
Tortoise Media.
Yes.
Do the research yourself. As they say in QAnon, do the research.
But she also says, more recently, Wilfred Wong, a religious fanatic.
Now, he was in the story that I did.
Who promoted the Hampstead case, is now in prison.
Yeah, because he tried to abduct a child that had been removed.
Yes.
From his foster family.
Yes,
exactly. Sorry, from his real family and fostered.
Well, she says here, they were convinced the boy's father was a Satanist and they were trying to smuggle the child abroad to reunite him with his batshit insane, her words, mother.
Right.
Wong and his co-conspirators received a total of 64 years in prison.
And then there's
says.
Britain's worst troll, who is, I think her name's Sabine. I can't remember her last name. She was a CERN scientist. She got so wrapped up in this that she was the one that was actually infiltrating people's emails and social media accounts and going on all the podcasts, which are far right, let's face it, conspiracy theory kind of peddling. She actually harassed all these families so much that it ruined lives, you know?
And kind of ruined her life too. Yeah, it did. If you go online, and certainly, like I said before, the renewed interest in this case because of the Channel 4 documentary, you will see people saying, how dare people not believe those poor children? There are still people out there who are saying, those children didn't lie. This really happened.
Okay.
Still raging on as a
Even
debate.
If those children who are now teenagers and young adults, and they have spoken anonymously to say that
they made it all up. They were forced. They were coerced.
They will back up the story, which is what I believe the truth. Even if they came out and told people, it still wouldn't fly. They want to believe what they want to believe. Yes. And it is because of the breakdown of trust.
Yeah, it is. And also people just cannot distinguish between reality and AI. I mean, even on an interiors Instagram account that I follow, so many AI pictures that you don't know what's a real interior. And that's just an interior, an innocuous interior. People going, why are you posting this? This is bullshit AI. That doesn't affect anyone's life, really. Mm. And then you take it from something as low grade as an interiors photo and take it all the way to the top
to the president Satanist dancing on a roof.
Yeah, well, yes, all that kind of stuff. But I will wrap this up just by saying Karen does end her email by saying, in any case, thanks for discussing the case so well. Much thanks, appreciated. Karen. Pat on the back to you, Geordie.
Thank you, Karen. I hope you're still listening, but I doubt it.
She could be an eavesdropper.
She could be an eavesdropper, in which case that you can prepare yourself, Karen. Buckle in.
And I will also say well done to you on a little story you talked about a couple of weeks ago of those men freezing in the backyard.
Oh, yeah.
So I just want to say something that touched me very deeply and it's really disturbed me. It happened a couple of weeks ago. Andreas and I were asleep. We got woken up. Helicopters flying over the town. And we thought, oh, that's never a good sign.
No.
The next day, it came to light that there was a family of five. They had gone hiking and actually ski touring. They were training for the race that Andreas had actually done, the Patrol de Glacier, which is from Zermatt to Verbier. You start at midnight, you have head torches, you ski tour, you then take your skis off, you climb, you run, you ski. In the dark.
That sucks.
It's because of avalanche danger. So it's for safety that they do it in the dark. But this family and one non-family member, six of them actually, were training. And they had super lightweight gear on. They had very lightweight clothes. They were just prepared to do the route and then end up back over the mountain where they were living. Well, the weather came in.
Oh, no.
And honestly, anyone who had seen the weather that day, it was insane. I don't know why they attempted it in the first place, but they called for a heli rescue at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't know why they didn't turn around about 4 hours earlier. And the heli was like, we can't come. It's too dangerous. The winds are too much. We suggest you dig down and create an ice cave so you can and huddle together and stay warm. Well, of course, they were found all frozen to death the following day. An entire family wiped out. It really stayed with me because it's literally so close to home. But also, it just shows how powerful nature is. And you can't fuck around with it. You can't go out. When your YouTuber fucking boyfriend says go outside in a little tank top and it's minus 30, don't do it. It's awful.
Mm.
Really, really heartbreaking. It was just a weird timely thing. And RIP to that poor family
who died
on the mountain. But I'm not going to talk about more things like that today because
how are you going to turn this around, Michelle? I'm depressed.
I know, it's very sad. I'm going to talk instead about near-death experiences.
Okay.
Sort of, because, you know, we've talked a lot about near-death experiences before on the podcast.
Yes.
It is one of my favorite things to look at because
there's almost
I think
a never-ending plethora of interesting facts and stories about near-death experiences, right?
Yeah, because there are so many question marks around what people experience, when they experience it, why, and what causes it.
Hmm.
And to me, obviously, that's endlessly fascinating. But essentially, with near-death experiences, there is an element of people looking down at their bodies from above before they are then kind of seemingly pulled back into themselves.
We've all heard that.
Yep. Or they see some kind of light or they're guided towards
a tunnel, a hand, a loved one beckoning them.
Exactly. Yeah. There are all the common experiences that people seem to have when they're not dead, but not alive.
The twilight.
They are in the twilight zone. And I wanted to sort of look a little bit at how a near-death experience is different to an out-of-body experience and how that's also different to astral projection because on some levels...
All the same?
Yeah, and a little interchangeable. Oh. So I found a couple of definitions. So for OBEs, which is not an Order of British
Excellence.
No, what is it? Out of Order of British
It's out of
Empire.
Body.
It is out of body.
We've talked about it before.
Yes. It's where a person seems to be awake and they see their body and the world from outside of their physical body as if they are in a different location, but their body isn't.
Uh-huh.
So it's more of a split of consciousness and body. Whereas near-death experiences, NDEs, it's like it says on the tin, you have to be near death or dead. And they happen in that state between someone who is considered clinically dead and then when they're considered alive again. And people who literally come back from the dead often talk about those things, you know, life flashes before their eyes, you know, glowing white light, all that kind of thing. And in many cases, no matter which experience happens to them, they also experience these intense feelings of serenity and joy and peace, and they want to go towards that light. And they might also feel detach from their body as if they're levitating. But the thing is, with an out-of-body experience, you don't have to be clinically dead to have that experience.
No, you can be meditating, can't you?
Exactly.
Or just a child.
Yes.
Children tend to do it.
Yeah. Obviously, alongside those two is astral projection, where you deliberately put yourself into a state of meditation.
Transcendental.
Or trance.
Yeah.
You sounded very Lucinda.
I am basically Lucinda, and a lot of people have said to me that I sound like her without even trying. So,
honestly, I'm just going to hold a space for you.
I am holding
to take
space.
In that information.
That is a very patient woman, though, and I am certainly not.
I'm holding huge lanterns of hope for you that you might become a patient woman, Geordie. Anyway, anyone who doesn't
that
know what
shit's
we're talking
not
about.
Married at First Sight Australia. Sorry, get in on it now because it's a fantastic experiment. Anyway, back to your story, Michelle.
Astral projection, I know we've talked a little bit about it before, where people say they feel like their spirit is traveling through the world and space. But then there's this almost fine invisible string that keeps them connected to their body.
Invisible string. I've heard that so many times. Like a lot of people, like things like witchcraft would say, you need to cut that invisible string if you're trying to break up with someone or something like that. Or, you know, when you're imagining things or doing some sort of spiritual work, invisible strings.
Yeah, invisible strings.
They happen a lot.
Well, that's what helps snap you back into your body when you finish astral traveling. It guides you back. You know, the common thing here is the spirit leaves the body, but you're not dead. And I sort of wanted to know more about what people experience. So there's this one account I found that kind of blurs the lines a bit between near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences. And it's the case of Dr. Rajiv Party. P-A-R-T-I,
I was
not a party.
He sounds like he likes a good time.
He does. Well, he says he had an out-of-body experience while he was having life-saving surgery. So already I'm thinking near-death experience or out-of-body experience. But on Christmas Eve in 2010, Dr. Rajiv was rushed into the emergency room at UCLA Medical Center after having some complications after treatment for pancreatic cancer. And at the point after his cancer op, he sadly couldn't control his bowels.
Oh.
So doctors had given him a catheter.
TMI,
sorry.
Mr. Party, Dr. Party.
Yeah, there's no partying for him. But that whole catheter thing did not go well for him because within hours he developed sepsis, horrible, you know, blood poisoning and infection and all that. And it was at the catheter site. He had a ragingly high fever. So the hospital sedated him with morphine, and the next day he was wheeled into the operating room. And it was at that moment that Dr. Rajiv says he saw what he believes was, quote, the afterlife.
Wow.
So he says that the general anesthetic he was given did absolutely nothing to stop the pain he was in.
Oh, no.
When they were operating on him.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, fucking scary. And 15 minutes into the sepsis surgery, when the surgeons inserted this new catheter, he was fucking gone with pain.
Because
it's like someone doing it with no pain relief at all.
And he was paralyzed.
Yeah, he couldn't do anything. So he could feel everything but couldn't move.
Oh.
So he says, yeah, he just, that's when he went out of his body.
Yeah, because you would disassociate in order to protect yourself. In extreme pain like that would do something to your mind.
Well, he says he remembers floating above and over the scene of his surgery, and he could see his own body being operated on. He could hear the surgeons talking. One even made a joke. I don't know what the joke was, but the whole hovering above bit, I get it. And the talking bit, because, you know, you're kind of semi-conscious, I would say. But at the same time he was watching his surgery, he says he was also simultaneously seeing his mother on the other side of the world in India. She was at home. She was wearing a green sari. She was sitting with his sister, who was wearing jeans and a blue top. And they weren't doing anything particularly exciting. They were just sitting around talking about cooking, what they were going to make. And eventually they decided to make vegetables, yogurt and rice. Dr. Rajiv says it was a very comforting feeling seeing his mum and sister. But it was short-lived because that beautiful scene of his home and his family in India immediately replaced by this terrifying change of scenery, because he said he was catapulted into this hellish realm.
Oh, no.
With black clouds, lightning, fire, horned creatures, all of it. And he says while he was in this hell, everyone he had ever been rude to appeared before him, including a patient. Geordi, this is fucking terrifying to me, because if this happened to me...
There it goes.
My God.
We've got the dentist. We've got the people at Gap. We've got those people at the Japanese restaurant in Brixton. They're all coming back.
The Japanese restaurant in Brixton? Which one? Oh, my God. So could many people.
TK Maxx, look out. The staff of TK Maxx are coming for you, Michelle.
Oh, my God. Do you know what?
Amazon. The lady on Amazon.
Oh, Jesus. The food delivery guy. Yes. Oh, they're all lining up.
The Indian restaurant.
They're all lining up. H&M when I had to return that skirt.
Yeah, oops.
Oh, man. Honestly, it would take an eternity.
And that's your afterlife.
That's my afterlife.
What happened to Dr. Party then?
Well, then somehow he was out of the depths of hell and his father appeared like a kind of spirit guide and walked him into a tunnel, which opened to, and these are his words, the light of 1,000 suns that did not hurt the eyes. Ooh. And at this point, Dr. Rajiv woke up. So at no point was he clinically dead.
Wow.
He wasn't heart stopped.
Could they not see his blood pressure going up and down, though? They would have been monitoring all that.
Well, I don't know.
Especially if he was in pain. That would shoot your heart rate up. Your blood pressure would go sky high.
I mean, technically, this is not a near-death experience because he wasn't dead. No. He was just under a general. But he was over his body. Like, he astral traveled to India and had a loved one, you know, try to take him towards the light. Wow. So it kind of ticks all the boxes. And he spoke to the surgeons and he asked them about that joke. And they were like, yeah, we cracked a joke. And he said, was it this joke? And I wish I knew what it was. And they were like, yeah, that's the joke. God. And, you know, I mean, it's good that they were having a good time while they were operating him. Operating on him. Anyway.
If you think so.
When you're elbow deep in a pussy wound, you've got to crack a joke, right? But what I found really interesting is that he spoke to his mum in India who said everything he described.
They had the same dinner. They were wearing the same outfit.
Everything. Wow. They were at home. It all happened. And it happened at the precise moment that he was under the general.
That's incredible.
So, you know, what is going on here? Is it a near-death experience? Out-of-body experience? Brain hallucination brought on by trauma or something else that happens when the body gets sepsis. I found another story of a man called Justin Cameron, who was at the time of his out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
He was 44, from Ottawa in Canada, like how lovely Karen Irving we just talked about from the same city. And he was admitted to hospital with sepsis and diverticulitis.
Yeah, that's a bend in the colon or something, isn't it? It's very uncomfortable.
I don't know. Well, apparently there are small bulges in the lining of the intestines, which sounds awful. And somehow this turned into peritonitis, which is an infection of the inner lining of the tummy. And he needed emergency surgery to remove part of his intestine. But while he was waiting for the operation, not during it, waiting to go in, he says he had what he thinks was a near-death experience because he remembers waiting for the surgery and feeling no pain. Instead, he had this really intense sense of regret alongside a feeling that somehow he was slipping away.
Oh, God.
And this is a quote from Justin. He says, all the cliches about life flashing before you are somewhat accurate.
Oh, no.
I saw a supercut reel of my life in an instant and I learned that death is painless. The sepsis was excruciating, but death was painless. The best way I could describe it is it was like the driver, i.e. me, was leaving the vehicle, the body.
I've heard that before.
At the side of the road because it no longer worked. The driver's leaving the cab by the side of the road because the cab's fucked.
Huh.
He said, I felt joy and love while at the same time a sense of regret for not having taken better care of my vehicle.
Okay, well, there's a little life lesson to
life everybody. Lesson. You see, you get it all on eavesdropping. You get the life lesson.
Cut back on the sugar, guys. Go work out.
Justin also says at that point in his life, he had become quite jaded and cynical, underwhelmed by the world and life. But after his near-death experience, he felt as though he had been given a new set of eyes and ears to hear and see the magic of the world, which there's so much here to unpack. Death is painless Amazing. Mm. That is just so comforting, I think. You know, the driver is leaving the car. Yes, okay. He should have given his body a few tune-ups and a lube job. You know, get it all, getting it better. We should all treat our bodies better. But I'm not sure it's a near-death experience because I don't know how close to death he was.
Yeah.
That whole seeing his life flash before his eyes, I don't think he actually felt like he left his body. I don't know. You know, we all have had scares in our lives that pull our own life into focus. Yeah. And in a second, we get that kind of moment of clarity that shines a light onto what's really important in life and what's not. And I think those moments are really, really important because you suddenly feel excited about life again and you get this kind of carpe diem feeling like you've got to seize the moment, enjoy every day, because it can all be taken away from you so fast. And, you know, you do often hear that people who've had near-death experiences come out of it with this newfound joy for life and appreciation kind of for all the preciousness of what we experience and it stays with them. Which brings me to a woman called Lynn Mildner, who I think had an NDE rather than an OBE. She's in her 70s now.
Yeah.
She's from King's Langley in Hertfordshire.
Uh-huh.
But when she was 30, she remembers seeing a beautiful white light in the distance and talking with dead family members.
Or just randomly? Like
after she was given a general anaesthetic.
Oh, okay.
Because she went in to have a wisdom tooth removed. But there was a complication with the extraction. And while she was under, she had to have her heart restarted a defibrillator. So she wasn't clinically dead, but she was on her way out, you know. And she says she remembers that when she was in a kind of limbo state, everything felt easy, like she was just drifting and floating and that she felt incredibly happy. And she said she reached some sort of entrance. She didn't know what it was an entrance to, but she knew it was an entrance to somewhere. And that next to the entrance was a spirit that she knew was her great aunt Nellie.
Oh.
Yeah. Nellie said, you know, she was her guardian spirit. And Lynn says she remembers that she could not wait to go through the entrance and meet her grandmothers. But Aunt Nellie was like, no. She said that Lynn had to go back because she still had things to do.
Okay.
And Lynn says she was really upset and she was begging Aunt Nellie to let her go through the entrance just for a little bit. Just for a little bit.
Aww.
Aunt Nellie was like, no.
Once in, you don't
Once
get
in,
out
you,
again.
You, there's no going back. So she had to go back to her body. And she said the journey back to her body was this uphill struggle through a dark tunnel. And it was really, really hard, as if she was fighting against gravity. And she didn't want to go back. And then the next thing she remembers, her eyes were flickering open and she saw people in scrubs holding her arms up and one of them was holding the paddles of the defib machine. And, you know, we hear again this all the time from people that have had near-death experiences that they're sent back because they're told it's not their time and they still have things to do. But I love the sound of that threshold, that there's this wonderful, happy, joyful place where all the people you love are waiting for you. We've said before on this podcast that these experiences, they seem to cross cultures and age groups and time frames and centuries.
Yeah.
People all seem to have this similar experience. And I don't know what to make of it. Is it some kind of spiritual thing? Is it a neurological thing? Because there's been recent research on neurological patients that apparently sheds light on how the healthy brain generates the experience of oneself. And what happens when that goes wrong is maybe what people experience as an NDE.
Yes.
There's this whole thing about this temporal parietal junction, which is a part of the brain, sits on both sides of the brain.
You're experiencing something you've never experienced before and you comprehend it in a certain way that makes sense to you when you are able to come out the other side.
Yes.
You see the, you know, you see the bright lights, you see the granny, you see the hellscape, you see the uphill struggle getting back into your body. But maybe you're not seeing those things at all. Maybe you're just, your brain is doing a little fancy dance for about 2 seconds.
Maybe. There's a whole lot of these cases out there about this temporal, parietal, temporal, junction, like part of the brain, that when that gets messed up, because it kind of processes empathy and memory and senses. So, you know, if the senses of vision and sound and touch and, you know, all those things that are joined up for your interior feeling of yourself, if they get jumbled, then that part of the brain is not going to work the way it should, and your experiences get jumbled up. And that's what people are maybe saying, that could be why people have an out-of-body experience. But either way, I think it's a nice, neat way to kind of explain things. But how does that explain the doctor who went to India and saw his mum?
Yes.
That doesn't explain that, you know?
No, but what does explain that is his mum was anxious about his operation. She was so thrilled when he came out the other side and he said all this stuff to her. And she was like, yes, 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 that's, I have that, a green sari. Yes, and I was probably wearing it that day as well. Yes, she was wearing jeans and a top because that's what she always wears, the sister. We usually have yogurts, rice, and yeah, so that definitely happened at that time. You definitely traveled because we were thinking of you at that time and you were thinking of us at that time. So let's make that be the case in our remembered memory.
Okay, that could also be true. So who knows? But I love looking into people's real life experiences of NDEs and OBEs and astral traveling. And God, one day I would love to astral travel, but
quiet that mind, Michelle, and maybe you can.
Woo!
Pick up your panties and go, Jin. Pick up your panties and go. You don't need that. Leave the kids behind. Pick up your panties and go.
Well, today I am going to talk about a few things. A little bit of a haunting later on for you, Michelle, but right now I want to ask you something. Have you heard of alien hand syndrome?
Absolutely fucking not.
It's also known as Dr. Strangelove syndrome.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Doesn't it? But it's a category of conditions where someone might actually experience their limbs acting on their own, apparently.
Oh my God.
And you have no control over the hand or the limb. Right? It's just like, boop! Oh, sorry, I've just punched Michelle in the face. Are you okay?
So it's almost like Tourette's of the body,
of the limbs, yes, of the hand mostly. Because it mostly affects the left hand for some reason. So I'd be fucked because I'm left-handed. I'm just thinking about all the things that I use my left hand for. If that suddenly went awry.
And you had no control over it. It had a mind of its own.
It really could get messy, Michelle. Oof. That's all I need to say. If you suffer from alien hand syndrome, you might sometimes reach for things and move them without actually wanting to or even meaning to the point where you might use the controllable hand to restrain the alien hand.
Okay.
Like it's like this, holding the hand back. No, 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 you mustn't.
Don't slap yourself in the face.
Exactly. It's like a comedy sketch from the 70s. Alien hand syndrome is best documented in cases where a person has had the two hemispheres of their brain surgically separated. What the fuck?
Ooh.
Now, that is gross sounding, but actually it's a procedure that sometimes is used to relieve symptoms of extreme cases of psychosis or epilepsy. So it's a thing.
Fuck, man. It sounds like what Nurse Ratched might have done.
Yes, lobotomies.
Lobotomies.
Yeah. It also occurs in some cases after brain surgery, stroke, infection, tumour, aneurysms, migraines, and degenerative brain conditions such as Alzheimer's or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is...
We bring up Mad Cow a lot, don't we, in these last few episodes.
There isn't one universal cause for alien hand syndrome, but it's always caused by damage to your brain in a way that disrupts your movement and control. But when you plan to move a limb or an arm, it activates loads of other neural networks within your brain. So it can be managed and treated using muscle control therapies such as Botox.
Oh, okay.
It's so good.
Ladies, you just need it. You've got
surgical Botox. Come on. It's also good for migraines, apparently, and teeth clenching.
Yeah, I have heard that.
But there are other meds you can take to help in some instances. So that was a little something I found on the internet, but it led me into something else to do with hands because I was scrolling along Instagram.
Okay.
And I follow the Devon Tourism Board because it's bloody gorgeous there. And I went on a camping holiday there last year, and I would like to spend more time there because it is totally gorgeous. It's the land of myth and legend. And it turns out it's also a bit haunted.
Okay.
King Arthur and the Legend of the Round Table and all that kind of stuff, that is from Cornwall and Wales. But also he did hang about a little bit in Devon. He engaged with the devil in a hurling match near Moreton Hampstead, which is between two hells, Helltor and Blackstone Rock. And there's a stretch of road around a remote area of Dartmoor in Devon that also saw an unusually high number of car and motorbike accidents in the early 20th century.
Okay.
So nothing to do with King Arthur. I know I misled you a little bit there. You're looking confused, and so you should, because I started talking about King Arthur, then realised he didn't really have much to do with Devon.
Right, okay.
It's mostly, and who knows if he's real. They say they found bits of him here and there.
Bits.
Well, you know, like a thigh bone or a chip of bone or something.
A
awesome.
D.
Not I'm, the D, I'm Michelle. Joking. Why do we have to go to the D?
Always
God.
Go to the D.
Basically, King Arthur's legend, it's so ancient, and is it real? You know, no one knows, but they have got places where it's said to have taken place, the legends and whatnot.
Okay.
Right. And there was this like a hurling game with the devil, apparently, Moreton Hampstead in Devon. But I'm talking today about this stretch of road where all these car accidents started in the early 20th century. And it's known as the Hairy Hands of Dartmoor.
Fucking hell. Okay, that sounds terrifying.
It's
Hairy Hands.
The Hairy Hands of Dartmoor. And it's in the area of Post Bridge in Dartmoor on the road now known as the B3212. And I'm sure I've driven along that. But according to this story, the Hairy Hands are a pair of disembodied hands that appear suddenly, grab the steering wheel of a moving car or the handlebars of a motorbike, and then force the person in that car or motorbike off the road completely. You know, when somebody's like grabbing the steering wheel.
Fucking Not that they do hell. That, but yeah. A pair of hairy hands.
Well, sometimes they're hairy, sometimes they're invisible, Michelle.
Right.
The first sighting was reported in 1910 when drivers and cyclists reported unusual accidents along the road between Post Bridge and Two Bridges in Devon in the Dartmoor area.
Okay.
And the victims of this crash or this unexplained phenomena described their vehicle as having jolted or swerved violently and steered off the side of the road as if something had taken control of the wheel and wrenched them out of control.
Jesus. I mean, this is kind of your worst nightmare. It's
yes.
the kind of thing that when, you know, you have that feeling of being on the road and then all of a sudden your brain says, if I just swerved a little bit, I'm going to kill
Yes.
myself and the other person coming along. I mean, we've all had this feeling of the kind of fragility of what we all do and the
trust
we put.
We're on the edge.
We put our trust in every other driver around us that they will do the right thing.
And what happens if they have alien hand syndrome?
Fuck, man, they're fucked.
Because this is one of the things I was thinking of, and that's why it led into this story. Because imagine you've got alien hand syndrome. You shouldn't be driving.
No. Get away from the car.
Step away, sir.
From the car.
Hand me your keys. So back to this story. The victims who had reported having hairy hands or invisible hands force them off the road from within their own car would usually run into a verge on the side of the road and usually survive. And it became local legend, as I said. And then in 1921, there was a man by the name of E.H. Helby, who was the medical officer for Dartmoor Prison. He was actually killed, Michelle, when he lost control of his motorcycle sidecar affair. I've written that because I don't know what they're really called.
I don't know.
It's a motorcycle with a sidecar.
Yeah.
What's that called?
A sidecar?
With a motorcycle attached.
It's just, I don't know.
Sidecar's the sidecar.
Yeah,
the
motorcycle's but it's just a motorbike. I don't know.
With a sidecar.
With a sidecar.
So it's a motorcycle sidecar affair.
Okay.
That's what I've called it. He had, now this is the queer part of the story, really, one of the queer parts, and it's, there's no explanation. I have looked. There's a lot of confusion. He had two young girls riding in the sidecar. They were apparently the daughters of the prison governor where he worked, which begs the question, why was he travelling with them? But then I found out that they were apparently his daughters, but then I heard that he didn't have children and it was all very confusing. There was a lot of newspaper articles that I used for...
There's a lot of misinformation.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces.
And also because it's so old as well, so it's twisted and turned over the years. Mm. But thankfully they survived, so they could bear witness to him shouting at them to jump out of the bike while he was wrestling with the controls because he realised something was amiss, like something's gone on here, girls.
Get out. Jump.
Exactly. This is a sidebar about Dr. Helby, by the way. I discovered this while doing the newspaper research.
Okay.
He was well known for something other than dying as a result of the hairy hands.
Okay.
But because of the hairy hands of Dartmoor being involved in his death, it was completely forgotten about.
Okay.
He was a prison doctor, as I've said, and he was involved in the force feeding of women suffragette prisoners when they went on hunger strike in 1909 at Winston Green Jail.
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that.
No, I don't feel good about it.
No,
but
I mean, that's, what a thing. That's awful.
Yeah.
Force feeding mm-hmm. anyone.
Yeah.
Fuck, man. Don't eat pate.
What?
Well, that's what they do to geese, isn't it? They force feed these geese.
Okay. That's probably not what they're doing.
They're okay.
The hairy hand struck again a while later with another motorcyclist. This time he had a pillion passenger, so someone on the back of his bike. And they also were seemingly driven off the road, approaching the same spot. This time the passenger saw things that he could recall clearly. So primarily he saw a large hairy hand grasp the handlebars.
Fucking hell.
And force the bike off the road.
That's crazy.
Tell me about it. Why hairy?
I don't know.
How hairy are they, I wonder?
It's an ape. Do you think it's an ape hand?
No, I don't think so.
Yowie.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because they're in Australia. Some weeks after Helby's death, there was another incident where the driver of an open-top coach, which was kind of like a bus thing back in mm-hmm. those days, lost control and several passengers were thrown out of the coach. One was seriously injured. Lots were hurt in this particular bus crash. And then on the 26th of August, 1921, a captain in the army claimed that a pair of invisible hands had taken hold of him and forced his motorcycle off the road. At this point, the media was sniffing around, Michelle.
Of course.
So the hairy hands of Dartmoor story became national legend. News. Exactly. Not legend, national news. It was yeah. reported as fact.
Yeah.
Now, there's a book called Supernatural Dartmoor by a man called Michael Williams. It was published in 2003. You can get that on Amazon or other bookstores which are available. And in this, the journalist and author Rufus Endell tells his own anecdote. He said that while he was driving his car near Post Bridge, a pair of hands gripped the steering wheel and he had to fight for control. And he managed to avoid crashing the car with the hands suddenly disappearing without any fanfare. Just suddenly, poof, gone.
So he's there really wrestling for control and putting a lot of, you know, strength and power yes. into doing that. And then the hands are gone. And then he's probably still
having to right himself. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But strangely, Rufus Endell asked the author, Michael Williams, please do not publish this story until after his death. He was concerned it might make him look a bit mad.
Well, yes, but his story is not in isolation.
True. But maybe he just didn't want to be lumped in with
yeah, those, with the crazy, you know. With people who think they are crazy. Yeah, of course.
But funnily enough, Michelle, it wasn't just cars and motorbikes that were victims of the hairy hats. In 1924,
yeah.
a woman camping on Dartmoor with her husband reported seeing a hairy hand attempt to get inside her caravan during the night.
No.
I can't sleep in my caravan anymore for fear
sexy,
of hairy hands.
Sexy hairy hands.
Well, no, her husband was with her, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was the sexy one.
Well, he wanted sexy times.
But what, with her and her husband?
Maybe.
How do you know what this hairy hand is thinking, by the way, Michelle?
I'm projecting.
Yeah. I think you are. But this quick-thinking, God-fearing lady made the sign of the cross at the hand and it shuffled away quickly. Back it goes.
Oh,
gone.
Oh, jeez.
Whose hands are these, Michelle? You said an ape.
Well, or Bigfoot, Yowie, whatever. Like, I don't know, but they're disembodied.
It's not a Yowie. They are disembodied. You can only see the hands. So locals to the area
mm-hmm.
have their own thoughts on the matter. And they attribute the hands to an unnamed man who died in a road accident on that particular stretch of road. But skeptics think that most of these accidents were just the result of people driving too fast down narrow country lanes and they had the high walled sides. It would be even more treacherous because they were driving down from London, hooray Henry's, going all a bit nuts, like, woo, you know, around the corners. Mm. They don't know the lay of the land and they're fucking up.
So you think booze? No hands, just booze. And then they're projecting this story onto...
Not booze. I didn't say booze.
I'm saying booze, but
you're
hooray
saying a lot
Henry's.
Of booze and sex here. Hooray Henry's are just la-di-da. You know, yes, come on, let's go. We're flying down from London right, to Dartmoor okay. and zip around for a jolly weekend. On October 14, 1921, readers of the Daily Mail read of these encounters in an article entitled The Unseen Hands.
Okay.
The writing was too small for me to be able to read, but I have given you a link
okay.
to it. After the story appeared in the papers, several road-based investigations were carried out, and it was eventually determined that the accidents were most likely due to the road's camber surface. Do you know what camber is?
No.
Camber is the way that the road slopes down towards the outside edge that aids drainage and rainfall, okay, so you don't get flooded roads and whatnot.
All right.
And this one had dodgy edges, so they fixed it and the accident stopped.
Okay.
You dickheads.
Okay.
But I have some Hairy Hands trivia.
Lay it on me.
If you want to hear more. There's a short play called The Hairy Hand of Dartmoor by Michael McStay that was broadcast on Radio 4.
Ooh, nice.
On the 8th of February 1999. So you could probably find that in the
archives
for yeah. BBC Radio 4. Then there's the comedian Josh Widdicombe. Do you know who that is? He's quite big here in the UK. I'm not sure if he's available in other countries.
I'm trying to visually...
If he translates.
I'm trying to...
He's short,
red...
ginger hair. Yeah. Yes.
Red. Ginger.
Ready, yep. Ginger hair. He mentioned the hairy hands on an episode of the panel show QI. Then he told the story again in series 2, episode 2 of the comedy panel show Hypothetical, which he hosted with someone else, I think James Acaster. Then on the 19th of April 2019, he was on an episode of Have I Got a Bit More News for You? And he mentioned it again. And then he dragged out the fucking story once more on the 28th of February 2020 in an episode of The Last Leg, where he was the token able-bodied comedian on that particular game show.
Right.
Or talk show, sorry.
God, he loves rehashing
he
this.
He loves the hairy hands. It probably won't be the last time Josh Widdicombe rolls out this old fave of his. He's really milking it.
Yeah.
But it's probably because he grew up in Hayter Vale, near a place called Widdicombe or Widecombe. I'm not sure. It's okay. Funny that his last name is almost the same, in the Moor on Dartmoor in Devon.
So lots of local lore.
Local
so he probably...
Lore. Hearing about it all
yeah,
his life.
Granddad trots out the story of the hairy hands.
Now, Dartmoor is an expansive area of natural beauty, and it does have that supernatural element to it. It's the setting for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles. Ooh. Don't forget, Conan Doyle was heavily involved in the occult in the 20s, in the 1920s.
We need to do a story.
We have mentioned him
before.
We've
mentioned him. We haven't done a solo deep dive.
He believed in fairies. He did seances, all of that. It's also been the location of many a big cat sighting over the years.
Ooh.
And like I said earlier, there were many supernatural legends when I dipped into my almost false story about Arthur, King Arthur, yes. And his gang. But there's a few more. If you Google Dartmoor and legend, all of these ones pop up. They're not terribly interesting. Like there's this one, The Legend of the Bed of Tulips. There's an old lady on Dartmoor who had a lovely tulip garden, and she saw one day pixies dancing among them every night. And inside the tulips, there was little baby pixies and all sorts. And she loved this. So she made sure that they had a lovely stocked garden every summer to dance about in. But then she died and someone moved in and dug up the flower garden.
What?
They replaced it with a fenced vegetable crop. And this made the pixies very angry, Michelle.
Oh, dear. What did they do?
Well, they made it so the garden would never grow vegetable crops or anything ever again. But on the old lady's grave, they didn't forget her. There was always a mass of beautiful flowers that bloomed every year. Now, I wanted more info on the hairy hands. That wasn't enough for me. So I had a little shufty around in my favourite corner of the internet, Quora.
We love that.
And this is what I found when I typed in the legend of the hairy hands. How did the myth that masturbation causes hairy palms start?
Of course, we've all heard this one.
That's what came up.
Yep.
And there was a post from Eugene Moorman. Not sure if this is his real name. In his intro, he states he has apparently been masturbating since 1965 and has not yet died from it. Now, he says... I believe it is one or more of the books written in the Dark Ages, usually by priests or just opportunists, that attempt to blame nearly every single bad possible conceivable thing on masturbation, also known as onanism or self-abuse. Along with this moronic propaganda they made up, they also invented various useless potions and lotions and sick sadistic devices and contraptions.
Ooh.
They'd lash down children to prevent it. They'd tie them up. Put little cages round their genitals with metal spikes pointing inwards, chastity belts and garments and more. They made quite a living from this insane horseshit they made up. But then no one would question a priest. And if they were told something by a priest, no matter how incredibly stupid, they'd likely believe it. No one knew that there were no hair follicles on the palms, and it is impossible to grow hair on your palms for any reason. Thank you, Eugene. So I refined my search and this came up. Have you ever held hands with a ghost?
How? How did that come up with hairy hands?
I was really looking. I was really reaching. Uncle Ozzy responded to this one.
Oh, thanks, Ozzy.
He says, oftentimes when dealing with earthbound spirits, the best way to interact with them is just like a normal human being, getting to know them and the like. And a ghost with a strong enough energy can actually interact with the living. So this might explain the hairy hands of Dartmoor. Also, ghosts tied to a certain place can sometimes only escape that place if a living person gives them enough energy. So in answer to your question, yes, I have probably looked damn silly doing it. The question being, have you ever held hands with a ghost?
Yes.
In case you'd forgotten. But in a case with the soul of a certain young person, I did in fact hold their hand to guide them from where they had died to where their family had been laid to rest so they could move on in peace.
Oh.
So with regards to the hairy hands of Dartmoor, Michelle, if it was still a problem, which it's not because they changed the camber and it's all fine, the best way to deal with it, if in case you do come across something like this again, is to be kind to the ghost and help to steer gently to the place where he's taking you or they're taking you, and then guide them to the spot where they may possibly have died and assist them on their way.
Aww.
Or you can laugh it off as a desperate attempt at a tourist attraction. Which I think it probably is.
Maybe. You know, I was thinking a little bit like the masturbation. It's all for a little bit of extra dollar.
Exactly. Why else would you go to Postbridge?
Well, exactly. Tourism, products. It's commerce, isn't it?
Probably. Obviously, people died. Josh Widdicombe enjoyed reeling out the story again and again and again. So it's got value for him.
It does. Obviously, people did die. So they're just joining the dots and creating some folklore. But I love it.
One person died.
Only one?
I think it was only one.
Lots of accidents.
I know two, because if you count the first person who apparently was the hairy hands.
Right. I wonder if they actually had hairy hands in real life.
How hairy are those hands?
Yeah, I know. I have seen men with hairy hands.
Or are they disembodied ghost hands with a bit of fuzzy wuzzy around the edge because you can't quite see them?
Maybe. Or in a hairy glove.
Could be the hairy glove.
Who knows? Wonderful story. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michelle. And thank you for your deep dive into OBEs and NDEs.
And a little bit of astral thrown in there. No, it wasn't so much a deep dive as I love hearing about what people see. You know,
it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, because there are always similar elements that come forward. Like we said before, loved ones, life flash before your eyes, the light, etc. But maybe a hairy hand can guide you along. Mm-hmm. Brilliant story.
I'm going to give you my hairy hand right now to guide you along and off this podcast now, because we are done for the day.
We are done for the day. And really, there's only three things left to say.
Wherever you are,
whatever you do,
just keep
eavesdropping.